Thanks a lot, Kendrick, and thanks everybody for coming. It's really a pleasure to be here as always. This visit was supposed to happen in April 2020, but I'm happy it finally happened, and you know, it's great to see everybody in person again. Today I'm going to talk about CMB and try to persuade you that CMB anisotropies are much more than just the primary CMB that you may be more familiar with. So let me just start. So, you know, many people think of the CMBs as kind of this very nice sort of Gaussian primordial field from which, you know, you can take the power spectrum, and from this beautiful power spectrum, you know, which this includes error bars, right? And the red curve is the theory fit, so it's really a great success of cosmology, you know, and you infer kind of the composition of the universe, and that's where, you know, you find out that, you know, you need to fit this data, you need about 70% of the energy density being some form of dark energy, which we don't understand, 24%, about 24% dark matter, and sort of the atoms we are familiar with is only less than 5%, okay? These models fit really well, but, you know, they're based on dark matter, which we don't really know what it is, dark energy, which we don't really know what it is, and inflation, which makes sort of a lot of predictions, which are tested and true to very good accuracy. So, you know, the CMB story has been really a success story so far, but I want to persuade you that there's much more to it. So the CMB is also so much more than this. Okay. Why is it the case? Is it because CMB, as you all know, is emitted when the universe was only a few hundred thousand years old at the surface of last scattering, and that's the edge, kind of by definition, that's the edge of the observable universe, at least with photons, because the universe was opaque to photons before that. But then CMB photons had to travel all the way through the observable universe until they get to our telescopes near the Earth. In doing so, they interact with the matter, and they interact with all of the matter in the universe, both gravitationally and through scattering. And so the CMB ends up, at least if you have you know, good enough resolution, ends up being a complete map of the whole observable universe, if you know how to use it, right? This is what we're going to make use of, is not so much the primordial fluctuations in this talk, but it's what happened to the CMB photons as they travel to us, and they get you know, both gravitational and scattering inputs. Okay? So to make the point more clear, here we are looking at some Planck map. So you see, you know, these hot and cold spots are kind of your really primordial information. That's where you get some cosmological parameters. If you go to a factor of 3 better resolution and considerably lower noise, so for example, map of the same part of the sky from the ACT telescope in the Atacama Desert. Now, first of all, you see that, you know, these broad, hot, and cold spots are in the same place. That's good news, right? Means, you know, everything is consistent. But then you start seeing a lot more. You see all these little dots, right, for example. And you see both, like, sort of cold spots, like here, here, here. These are TSZ clusters, right? And in fact, the resolution of this map is good enough that you can resolve their profile individually. And also you see a number of, like, bright spots, hot spots. These are AGNs and dusty star-forming galaxies and strong gravitational lenses usually. So you see that as you go to small scales, you do get an imprint from the large scale structure, and then, you know, people including Kendrick and I have pointed out you can look for reionization in the CMB, you can look for, you know, galaxies, gassing galaxies, galaxy formation, etc. And also gravitational lensing, which I'll talk about in the second part of my talk. So more specifically, photons interact with matter. How do they do it? Gravitationally, CMB lensing is the biggest probe, but there's also effects to time-varying gravitational potentials, for example. There are scattering processes, mostly Thomson scattering and Thomson regime. These go in depending on the relative motion between the electrons and the CMB, they go under different names, the thermal Sunyer-Zeldovich, kinematic Sunyer-Zeldovich. I'll talk about both a little bit. Then there's also smaller effects in polarization, which I won't go into many details, but those are very interesting. And finally, there's emission from late-time matter. This is not really CMB per se, but they still, you know, things like infrared emission from dust or the cosmic infrared background, you know, they end up in your CMB map. So whether you like it or not, they are there, and you can use them as a signal as well as noise.
AMP,
anomalous microwave emission. So what people used to think is due to spinning dust is this 30 gigahertz bump extra emission. But you know, now there's a bit of controversy, and I haven't followed the latest developments, whether it's spinning dust or not. But anyway. So it is one of the components that end up in your CMB maps. Okay, so this talk I will focus on CMB lensing in the second part of the talk, and the Sunyazov-Dovich effects in the first part. Okay, so there's two parts. One is trying to image the gas around galaxies with the CMB, and the second is on CMB lensing and how it can inform some sort of cosmology, ghost of structure, etc. All right, so first part is in collaboration with Manu Shan, Stefania Modeo, Nick Battaglia, the ACT team, and this includes a lot of help from Kendrick Smith as well. Perfect. So let's start with the kinematic Sunyazov-Dovich effect. It's really, really simple to understand. So galaxies have a lot of free electrons, you know, maybe 90+% of gas in galaxies from ionized plasma. So free electrons like to scatter photons through Thomson scattering. And now if the galaxies are moving, which they are moving because they just fall into sort of gravitational potentials, and they move in cosmic velocity fields, then once you have the scattering, you have a Doppler shift due to the motion. It's really like playing tennis against a moving wall. You know, you get the photons that bounce off will have a Doppler shift, right? And this is very easy to understand. So the fractional change in temperature is given by, you know, Thomson scattering, cross section, times the column density of electrons. So, you know, this is how many, Thomson scattering, cross section, times the column density of electrons is the probability of scattering. And V over C, where V is the radial velocity, is just the Doppler shift, the non-relativistic Doppler shift, if you do scatter. Okay, so this formula is very easy interpretation. But you notice that it really factors out in something that has to do with the baryon or gas distribution in the galaxies, and something has to do with cosmology, which is the velocity field. Okay, in this talk, I will only consider baryon distribution part of this, and assume we know the cosmology. However, in collaboration with Kendrick and Matt Johnson and many other people here, we've also really extensively explored what you can do with velocities, for example, using this Kz effect to reconstruct velocities and do cosmology with those. So that won't be in my talk, but I'm happy to chat or your chat with Kendrick, Matt. Okay, so going back to this, but the astrophysics part, why do we care how the electrons are distributed around the galaxy? I remind you, this Ne is just the column density, projected number density around the galaxy, is because this distribution is very uncertain. We have what's called the missing baryon problem, which has been well known for a long time. That is, if you look at kind of late time galaxies and you sum up all the gas that you see, it only amounts for, you know, less than 10% of the cosmological abundance that you measure, for example, from the CMB. Okay, so the question is, where are they? Well, presumably they've not disappeared. Presumably they are either in the outskirts, or they've been blown out, or something like that. And we'll come to that later, but you have to remember that the baryons or gas is 16% of the mass, right? So this is a major systematic for weak lensing, especially on small scales, because, you know, if you want to do kind of lensing to 1%, you need to know where 16% of the mass is, and I'll show more about that later. Okay, so why do we put a lot of effort in trying to measure this case, even though it's a very small signal, is because, first of all, it's independent of redshift, so that's nice. It preserves the black body spectrum of the CMB. So when you try to make a CMB map that is as clear from foregrounds as possible, that's already like the best map you can have for KSZ. So it's in all your CMB maps. It's a linear dependence on the column density of electrons. So that's not true, for example, for other observations like X-rays or, you know, TSZ. They depend non-linearly in the number of electrons. So then you have more modeling assumptions when you're trying to find where the gas is. And it's also suitable for low density or lower density environments than some of the other probes. So, for example, X-rays are really good for large clusters, but they quickly, you know, you quickly run out of signals, good for a mass. Well, KSZ is really good for that. And also is independent of temperature and metallicity, again, giving you robustness with respect to modeling assumption. Okay? And as I said, it's a tiny signal, okay? So it's about for if you take a 10 to the 13 solar mass halo, that's kind of galaxy group size, and you take the RMS one-dimensional velocity dispersion about 300 kilometers per second, then the signal is about 0.1 microkelvin, right? Okay, so that should be compared to, you know, the kind of standard CMB fluctuations that are about 100 microkelvin, right? So this is a tiny signal, and that's why we'll need a lot of galaxies to stuck on and to detect it, and that's why it took so long to detect it, and only now we have really precision measurements.
Understand, is it? It cannot really be disentangled from the thermal loss from Jensen Deutsch, right? The VR that we had before is in principle the combination of the thermal velocity of the gas.
Oh, no, I mean, it's a spectrally, you distinguish it spectrally. So this preserves the, you know, it's just a Doppler-shifted black body, so it's still a black body, while the thermal signature, which is actual spectral distortion. That has to do with the velocity dispersion. I'll come to that in a moment. So you actually, these estimators are pretty, the way we estimate, I am happy to go more into the technical details, but we think, you know, you can distinguish the two pretty efficiently. All right, so let me show you a practical example of what this looks like with some recent work. So we'll start with the biggest spectroscopic catalog that's available, at least when we are doing this analysis, which are the Bosse's CMAS galaxies. They have a little less than a million galaxies, a redshift 0.4 to 0.7. These are fairly large galaxies, so galaxy groups 2 to the 13 solar mass is the median. It's very well understood spectroscopic sample. People have done a lot of analysis on this, so we could use a lot of that work. And we're going to use maps from the Atacama Cosmology Telescope. So these are the beam is about 1.4 arc minutes compared to the, for example, 5 arc minutes of Planck. They have low noise, so a factor of 4 smaller than Planck, and they've been foreground reduced as much as possible using multiple combinations. And then we went out and we tried to measure the gas density with KZ. Yeah.
What is the area overlap in the two?
In this case, it was a few thousand square degrees because we were using these old DR5 maps. So it was, it's about 8,000 square degrees, I believe. Yeah, but we have more overlap now with the DR6 in the canvas, which we're using now. So here I'm going to show exactly what I talked about in terms of kinematic Sunyer-Zeldovich effect. So here is what exactly what we did. We did some stack around galaxies. So here I'm showing the signal as a function of aperture. This is, imagine putting down a disk centered on the galaxy, and this is the aperture in arc minutes, or if you want to know it in kind of physical units, in moving megaparsecs up there. And on the y-axis, I'm basically showing the cumulative baryon profile. So how many baryons essentially do you detect within a disk of a certain size? Okay, the viral radius is here, about 0.8 megaparsecs. So this is what the, you know, these are the measurements. And up here is what for halos of the same size, what you would predict if the gas traced an NFW profile, which we think the dark matter does, okay? So first of all, you see a huge difference between, of course, distribution of baryons and dark matter because it's more complicated for gas physics, which affects the baryons. Secondly, within the viral radius, you see a huge deficit of baryons. About a factor of 10, right? One order of magnitude deficit from what you would have if the baryons trace the dark matter. So this is nothing but the missing baryon problem. It's actually one of the nicest ways to illustrate this missing baryon problem. It is indeed there. What was new and really exciting about this measurement is that with the small error bars, we were able to trace the profile all the way out to like 3 viral radii or so. And you see that if you go this far out, then you do recover the kind of cosmological abundance of baryons, which is this dashed lines up there in the outskirts, but you have to go to like 3 viral radii to recover the cosmological abundance. And we were really excited and really happy to see this, because now essentially we are able to show directly with observations. Of course, the gas hasn't disappeared. It's still there. It's just a bit further out than the viewer radius. And we were able to quantify how far out you have to go. So I think this was the first measurement of its kind.
So how do you distinguish the kinetic Zinoviev effect from primordial perturbations? Yeah, because you say it preserves the thermal spectrum. So
that's right. So this is stacked at the galaxy position. So the primordial perturbations, which are uncorrelated modulo SW, where the galaxy positions are, they cancel on average. And indeed, our error bars take into account that on large scales and large aperture, these error bars are the ones at large aperture are indeed dominated by the primordial fluctuations. That's our main source of noise, but it's not source of signal; it's just source of noise, and that source of noise is taken into account. So the error bars at large aperture are dominated by the primordial fluctuations.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you.
So to do this stacking, do you also need to have some sort of estimate for for the velocity?
That's right. So here I don't have time to go into the full details, but yeah. So we use the continuity equation together with density, and that's some work. That Kendrick led actually to reconstruct velocities using continuity equations. So you have at least some idea, some noisy estimate of the velocity, and then you stack weighted by the velocity, so you avoid cancellation in the stack. And that's the actual correlation between the true and reconstructed velocity is something you have to take into account in the analysis, because it goes in the normalization. I'm happy to chat a lot more about that. It's just
Hello. Do you have a discrimination power between protons and helium?
So can you? I can't hear.
Discrimination power between protons, hydrogen and helium.
Hydrogen and helium. Here it's just really electrons, right? Is the dominated by wherever they come from. And then you can say you can look for effect of reionization, either hydrogen reionization or helium reionization. But we think they both happen way higher redshift than these galaxies. Last reionization of helium should happen around redshift 3 or something, and this the highest redshift is about 7 here. So everything should be close to fully ionized modulo the gas you have in stars, right?
I think it would be fair to say would be a degeneracy between the helium abundance and the density,
I completely agree, but here you notice it's log scale, right? In this, yeah. This over. So that's a tiny effect, yeah. And also we think that we know helium abundance way, way, way better than zero bars, yeah.
There were some ideas that helium can, there could be sedimentation of helium in the inner parts of halo. So that could be something that could be tested. I don't know if that's what Jumo was talking about, but that could be something.
I see. But yeah, you just see the sum of all the electrons from
just one more question. At least to my eye, it looks like the joint fit, the solid line, are going to surpass the NFW fit. Many radii away.
Yeah, so the error bars, you don't really detect anything way past this. It's normal, by the way. I should have said it's a technical details that I'm skipping over, because otherwise I would never finish the talk. But what you're seeing here is the sum of one halo and two halo terms, right? Where this is one halo only. So if you include, and in all of our inference we include the two halo two, this will go up to So the reason this keeps going is likely not because there see more electrons associated with this galaxy. You're seeing other galaxies that are correlated with the In the interpretation that I'm going to show, we do model both one and two halo. Cool. So you see the missing baryon problems, you recover the cosmological abundance at about 3 viewer radii. you know, this symptom very rich physics, why did they differ so much? Is the product even star formation, adiabatic mixing, accretion, feedback from star supernova AGN? We think actually for this mass range, feedback from AGN is probably the dominant effect. All of this depends on mass and redshift. Previously we didn't have the sort of statistical power to do it as a really split things about mass redshift, color, etc. Now we do with DESI, so that's exactly what we're working on. And so it'd be really interesting to see how these things depend on all the properties. And also it's a really large effect on weak lensing. So how am I doing on time? Okay, I'm late, but that's okay. So you can also measure thermal Sunyer-Zeldovich effect. This is a spectral distortion, so it modifies the black body of the CMB. And it has to do with the velocity dispersion, so it's V squared instead of V in the cluster. We have the same as temperature, right? The velocity dispersion is temperature. So you can measure that, this is the measurement. What that measures is any sigma Thomson times the column density of electrons times the temperature, okay? So you remember that Kz was times velocity, and here is times the temperature, which is velocity squared. With this measurement as well, what really nice thing you can do is you can kind of have a model-independent measurement of temperature, right? Because the Tz we said is proportional to this, and the Kz is proportional to this times some velocity RMS that you know. So if you divide the two and you put it in proper units, the ratio Tz to Kz gives you the temperature, right? So you can do that. And again, you can measure the temperature all the way out to so the 3 radio. So you can compare that to kind of some very simple kind of astrophysical models. So for example, you can take a isothermal sphere, a critical isothermal sphere, and ask what's the virial temperature, and is this dashed line here. So you see this close to the center. It's not a bad approximation. Of course, the physics of a real galaxy group or cluster is more complicated than just an isothermal sphere, which has no cooling, no heating, nothing, no shocks. Right, so you know, temperature decreases expected far in the outskirts, but the nice thing is now we can get good measurements of temperature in the outskirts, which were not previously available. Okay, then you can do good. You can take all of this and you can try and interpret it in terms of physical properties of the halo and the halo thermodynamics. You can ask what fraction of pressure is a non-thermal pressure support, what fraction of the rest mass energy had to be injected to, you know, change the profile from an NFW to the measured profile, what's the amplitude to halo term, both Kz and Tz. And I won't go into any of the model in details, but you get something is interesting, about 30% of the pressure support is non-thermal, which is kind of on the high side of what simulations can find, but certainly not crazy. And then you have to also inject about 30% of the binding energy of the halo to at least the gas to explain, you know, how different these profiles are. And in fact, you know, the profile is very different from the dark matter. So it's normal that you have to inject all the unity of the binding energy to explain what we are seeing. And this is all, you know, it will get much more interesting once you can really do this functional mass and redshift, for example. So, you know, really study halo thermodynamics. Last thing I want to see about this is that the effect on weak lensing. So, you know, baryons are, as I said before, 16% of the mass. So it's a statistically large effect on weak lensing. You know, a lot of work previously has found, especially on small scales, that the amplitude is smaller than what you expect, the lensing amplitude. This discrepancy, as I said, is larger on small scales, which are the ones that are most affected by baryons. So here's an example, some older paper by Alexis Luteau and collaborators, where they looked at this exact same galaxy sample that we looked at. But now what they're plotting is sort of surface mass density as measured by lensing versus the same aperture that we were. And here you have several models of sort of how galaxies populate halos. But you see that while you have some sort of order 20% variance between these models, the data points are systematically low. And these are very small scales, right? And the question, the natural question is, can variance being very different from the dark matter, explain this? And in particular, this is the range of scales that we measured, where I was showing you the results. So you say if you take the gas to have the distribution that we measured rather than the same as a dark matter, can this explain how low the signal is? The answer is that we use these measurements, and this is what we get. So the green points are the same points as before. The red line at the top is if you assume that the variance traces the dark matter exactly, while this blue line with the blue sort of uncertainty band is if you use our measurements of the variance, say the dark matter follows NFW, but the variance follow the measured distribution. So first of all, you see that you have about 16% suppression on small scales. That's just say that the variance have been pushed out to the halo, so they are no longer there and they no longer contribute to the to lensing. While on very large scales, we said we recover the cosmological abundance. So in large scales, there can be no effect. And on intermediate scales, of course, it goes one next year. The other. Our blue band is our best prediction. So first of all, you see that it doesn't completely explain, why lensing is low. That's our prediction. But it explains about half of the discrepancy, okay? And the other thing to note is that this is inevitable. I mean, we know baryons don't trace the dark matters. We have measurements. So, the correct theory curve should be this blue one. You cannot sort of assume the baryons trace dark matter, but there is something more going on here. And now there's a lot of work that has gone on recently about sort of galaxy halo connection, etc., that may be able to explain, for example, the environmental dependence of galaxy formation may be able to explain the remaining difference. Okay, but about half is variance, and we know that. And we also have to work in progress. Let me just say that in the next part of the talk, so this is the end of my first part of the talk, but in the next part of the talk, I will focus on sort of these scales, very kind of large scales, which are the ones that we think we can, with linear theory, with perturbation theory, are the ones that we think we can reliably use to do cosmology. And you notice that already in these measurements are quite old, right? You see that they're kind of a little below the theory curve, and these are in a regime where we think baryons don't really play a big effect. So we don't think the suppression is due to baryons. So the question is there anything more there? Okay. I'm gonna. If you have any more questions on the gas, now is a good time to ask, because then I'm gonna. Yep.
So I'm curious about how the gas was when compared to hydrodynamic simulations.
Yeah.
Gauge how much baryonic effects we need to protect against.
That's right. So that's work in progress. In this paper with Amodeo, there was some comparison to illustrious CNG. The short answer is we couldn't match the amount of feedback, and the amount of feedback that we were finding is a bit larger. That said, now there's much more work ongoing on the new version, is Millennium TNG. So there the jury's still out. We don't know. And matching these exact samples on hydrodynamical simulations is also quite hard. And a little bit depends on the modeling assumptions. So I would still say that it's work in progress. I'm not entirely. It looks like they disagree. I'm not 100% sure they disagree. Okay, let's put it that way. Okay, but the nice thing is for spectroscopic samples, for GG lensing, you can do this measurement exact same sample that where you do your lensing model measurements on, right? Like we did here with BOSS, right? So then that means that there's really very little modeling needed in a sense. Okay, you're perfect. Okay, great. Okay, so let me move on and ask, is there anything sort of going on here? Okay, and this goes under lensing plus correlations. So before I get there, I just have to give a very, very much too simplified version in one slide of how galaxy weak lensing works. So you measure, you know, you get measure galaxy positions, but galaxy weak lensing surveys also measure galaxy shapes, and they are distorted by matter, and they are distorted in a, you know, if you have a lens at the center, they are distorted in a coherent way, in particular, they're elongated tangentially to the source of matter, and that goes under the name of galaxy shear, and is measured very well by several surveys. You also measure galaxy positions, and you do this in a number of redshift bins. Okay, and then for each bin, you can form three two-point functions. You have the autocorrelation of the shear, the cross-correlation of shear with the galaxy position, and the galaxy clustering. And so this goes, when you combine them, it goes under this kind of name of like 3 cross 2 analysis. If you think about the parameter sensitivity, you know, shear is proportional to, you know, sigma eta gives you the matter fluctuations, but shear really cares about the total amount of matter in your lens, so you have to multiply by some factor of omega matter, while galaxy clustering mostly cares about, you know, sigma 8 times galaxy bias, just keeping into the linear regime here. So when you combine these two, for example, you know, combining auto and cross correlation of shear, you find that the most sensitive cosmological quantity is this value, which is sigma a times the square root of omega matter, because you only have one power of omega matter here, while two powers of sigma 8 when you take the product. So this is the quantity that these surveys can measure best. When I started getting interested in this, it was back a couple of years ago, maybe. And so this was the kind of state of the art back then. You had the Dark Energy Survey Year 1 here in yellow. You had the Kids 1000 here in red. Notice that the contours are smaller just because they combine with some spectroscopic data as well. And then you had some measurement on BOSS, which is the sample that that I showed you before, you know, they were all lying to this kind of a lower left corner compared to the Planck. So contours from primary CMB, and indeed this quantity is best constrained. This SA is in this direction, and you know, we have this simple analytical understanding of why this is the best constrained quantity. While you see lensing doesn't have that much sensitivity along this this perpendicular direction, the sigma 8 omega matter plane, and that's something that's well understood. I mean, it was. In fact, I think if the power spectrum is the exact power law, this would be an exact degeneracy, right? And it's not exactly a power law, it's not exactly, you know, Zen is a bit broken, but it's also not very robust how you break it along this direction. We're lensing alone, you need external data. Here was the status. You can measure this quantity also from Planck. This is the number you get, 0.83. Is it Planck alone? No. So if you take WMAP and you add BAO, then you get the same number. If you take WMAP for the large scales and ACT for the small scales, you also get the same number with the slightly bigger error bars. Okay. While if you looked back in the days, you know what constraints you get from say kids and DES, they were about, you know, 10% low, 10-15% low, about around 0.7. And they're fully compatible. They were fully compatible with each other. Okay. This talk is about CMB. So the natural question is, can CMB weigh in here? And let's say CMB lensing weigh in here, and whether there's a discrepancy or not. The CMB lensing alone is not very constraining. It's a factor of several larger error bars. Once you add BAO, it becomes a bit more constraining, but it's still not at the level where you can really tell whether there's a tension or not. But the kind of the central value, at least, is fully compatible with the Planck primary CMB. Okay. So the question is, what's going on? Can, you know, CMB lensing be actually competitive with galaxy lensing surveys. So that's what we were asking. And so, of course, if you want to extract most information from some field, you can cross-correlate it with other fields and use extra degeneracy breaking to answer. So what do we want in a galaxy survey if we want to cross-correlate with CMB lensing? Ideally, we want a really good galaxy survey so we get similar statistical power to galaxy lensing. We want to be able to isolate redshift information, so hopefully more than one redshift bin, and also use different systematics and techniques, which is what CMB lensing brings to the table. Then we did some thinking, and this unwise galaxy catalog is what, which I'll describe in a minute, is what sort of came up as our favorite. What I'm going to say next is mostly based on these two papers, and I really want to highlight the heroic effort of Alex Kolesky here, sitting right there. Now he's a postdoc here at PI, and this was mostly part of his thesis, and he did all of the heavy lifting, so all the credit goes to him. But also all the hard questions. What is unwise? So WISE was a NASA satellite that was initially sort of designed to detect near-Earth asteroids that were going to destroy the Earth. It turns out, of course, it's a full sky, infrared satellite, so it detects a lot of galaxies. Its catalog has more than a billion sort of extragalactic objects. UNWISE is a reprocessing, is kind of post-facto reprocessing of the WISE data. So there are over 500 million galaxies at redshift 0 to 2. It's full sky, which is great for cross-correlations with Planck. You can select, based on color, three samples at redshift roughly 0.5, 1, and 1.5. That fully covers the dark energy-dominated era and the transition into matter domination. And we're going to use the Planck 2018 CMB lensing maps as provided by the Planck team. So let me start with the redshift distribution. The difference between top and bottom is not really important for this talk. We can talk extensively about how we do the redshift distribution. Here's just want to point out, the blue sample is a redshift, 0.5 to 1. The green sample peaks a redshift a little above 1, and the red sample is very high redshift, sort of centered at redshift 2. And there are some interesting features which we think are real. They are not super smooth redshift distribution, but nonetheless, they are totally usable. Okay, so when you take auto and cross-correlations of this sample, so the galaxy autocorrelation, so this is the GG, is these blue points here for the three bins. And these are error bars, right? So it's really high significance. You remember you have more than 500 million galaxies in here. And also it's a cross-correlation with CMB lensing is very significant. It's about 60 sigma in the lowest redshift bin, about 70 in the intermediate one, and 40 in the higher redshift bin. So when you combine these, the total signal-to-noise lensing is about 100. So now you can already see when we saw this is like, okay, we can probably extract to some amplitude information like SA to two order, a few percent error, which is exactly what we want to do because that's what would be comparable to galaxy lensing. Okay. So all of the cosmological analysis, which was a year and a half or something, all in one slide. What did we do? So of course, before we even start doing any cosmology, a very large number of systematic checks do these cross correlations depend on where you are in the respect to the galactic plane, north versus south. There's a lot of very, very large number of systematic tests. So I have some slides about these if you're interested later. Then we need a theory model. We picked some flavor of this effective theory of large-scale structure. There's many in Eulerian Lagrangian space. They're all more or less equivalent. You have to remember to include magnification bias. We would be very biased if we did not include magnification, okay? But it's reasonably straightforward to do. We think we're doing it correctly, but you cannot Forget about that. The analysis was blinded to cosmology. What that means is that all the analysis choices, while we had looked at sort of the, you know, the band powers before, all the analysis choices are fixed in simulations. Here I show some simulations for the green sample before we actually run chains on the actual data. So the analysis is blinded to cosmology. So we didn't know until we unblinded sort of what we would get out. So we did a lot of tests on mocks. We have a way to marginalize over redshift uncertainty. When you do that, you end up with a small noise bias that you can subtract by Monte Carlo. Use the full covariance matrix between all of the samples. Then once we decide to unblind, we unblind each sample separately. Then we check for consistency. That's a good thing to do before you combine any data. You want to make sure that they are consistent, otherwise you get like nonsense out. And once we decided they're consistent, then you can sort of combine them into full results. Okay, so without further ado, a year and a half later, we got to unblind. And so here are the three samples. First of all, the purple in the center, the small one is Planck. And then we have the red, the blue, and green samples. I remind you, the red is the redshift 2 sample. The blue is the lowest redshift sample, 0.5, and the green is a redshift 1. So first of all, they are fully compatible. The red is not adding much, so I won't be talking too much about the red. The blue and the green are fully compatible. They are a bit lower than Planck. Since they are fully compatible, we can sort of combine them into sort of our final results. So this is the value for say that we get as 0.776 with a couple, you know, the error is about a couple of percent versus Planck is 0.83. So this is 2.6 sigma low on this parameter. Okay. How does it compare with the previous galaxy dancing surveys that I showed you? Here is this kind of green contours versus DES year one and kids. And you see that along this direction, the SA direction, we are fully, fully compatible, right? And in a sense, I was a little bit, I come from the CMB, right? So I was a little bit skeptical. I didn't fully understand the galaxy lensing surveys, right? So I was, I had some healthy skepticism, right? And I was like, oh, CMB lens is going to solve all of this, fully agree with Planck, but we don't, right? We fully agree with lens, with galaxy lens. Okay? I was surprised, but that's, and we did a lot of tests, so I think pretty confident of this. Yeah.
You can combine these to get one.
We can. There's a lot of subtle issues of the number of parameters and some are common, some are not common, some analysis choices are different. So you can't just multiply these likelihoods. Like the combination will take a little bit more work, but yes, indeed. I'll come to that, right? So the galaxies are exactly they're completely independent. Some analysis choices or theory methods or something are not so independent. Statistics is independent, systematics not necessarily 100% independent. But yeah. But of course, we all knew that DES year three was also finalizing the analysis, and that this essay would be the number that they constrained the best. So we were a little nervous, right? So we put out our paper, and this was from the abstract. This is the final value of SA that we believe. And so a few weeks later, there was this webinar announcing the DES year three result. I got a screenshot of what they get. It was really amusing to me that the number, not only the number of S8 was exactly the same, but also the error bar was exactly the same, right? What's the chance? Of course, this coincidence, but what's the chance that this happens? I don't know. But anyway, so so of course some of our DS friends got emails saying, okay, you've really entered the era of precision cosmology, right? This slide, is entertainment purposes only. Of course, the parameter sets are different and the analysis choices are different. So they're not directly comparable, but at the very least, they didn't show that we screwed up. Okay, so we're very relieved. I'm very happy. Okay, but what was interesting to me is, despite this sort of similar numerical results, we gave quite different interpretations, right? Our interpretation is that we do have a 2.6 sigma tension, but DS interpretation, I don't want to mischaracterize it, but it was more like softer, it's more like along the lines, in high dimension, the disagreement is not that bad, so there's probably nothing to see here. So anyway, this is something, a point I will return to later, because I think it's really key here. They don't in this paper, but I think it's probably because it's a final review or something. I don't know, or whatever. Anyway, I'm not in the S. Okay. So a lot of people ask about what about photoses? Photoses are hard. These galaxies are very far away, right? And if you don't have a spectrum, And I think the claim is, of course, photoses are well characterized and not the limiting factor. And that's the same claim we make with unwise. But we still both DS and us were using some sort of photometric redshift. But now we are lucky enough that DESI has just finished collecting first year of data. DESI is a dark energy spectroscopic instrument. It will do kind of a factor of 40 better than BOSS in terms of number of redshifts. So really, it can create the largest map of the universe to date, three-dimensional map, say. They have several samples. The LRG sample, luminous red galaxies, I don't have time to go really into much details, but they're kind of nicer samples for cosmology. Very small systematics, very well understood, sample, a very small clustering systematics, etc. You can divide this sample into four bins that I'm showing here. And what you do is, we already have collected 18 million spectra, right? So you can characterize the redshift distribution of each one of these samples, basically with zero error, for practical purposes, with zero error, okay? With 20 million redshifts. Spectroscopic completeness is very, very close to 100%. So everything, both the core and the tails of this distribution, is completely well characterized. There's really no problem on redshifts here, okay? We have spectroscopic calibration of all of them. So, of course, we try to cross-correlate them with Planck CMB lensing and see what we get, right? If redshifts were the problem, we would expect that this sample is super clean, no redshift problems, would get something that's compatible with Planck. So these are some recent work. And these are actually the first, as far as I know, the first cosmological results from DESI. So that was quite exciting. And here we did it in these four redshift bins, right? And you systematically find something that is low. And in fact, we don't even find much evidence that structure grows between redshift 1 and 0.5, right? Which is very surprising and very, very interesting, okay? And we did a lot of tests and we don't know what's going on, okay? But again, you publish what you get when you're tried everything. I think, how do we get out of this, right? One thing you can do is jointly analyze the 3D redshift space power spectrum together with this lensing cross-correlation that breaks a lot of these degeneracies between galaxy formation biases these biases equivalent to these biases in perturbation theory and sort of the things that enter in lensing. Okay, so I think this is really the way out, or the way we're going to understand what's going on. Okay, this is what I'm looking forward to. Okay, so lastly, just a provocative slide, okay? So this is, there's absolutely no statistical significance in what I'm gonna say, so don't go and say Simone claimed that, okay? But just as a kind of a pure observation, you know, primary CMB is redshift 1000, right? But then the CMB Lansing in SA, it comes here and it's a redshift, you know, peaks about redshift 2. Then our unwise is dominated by the green sample, which is a redshift 1, right? And then these kids and DS and DESI results are a lower redshift, right? And you see, you seem to find like some trend, okay? Which again is not statistically significant, but nonetheless, I think it's kind of intriguing. So at least it gives us motivation to do a lot more work on this. So as I said, combining 3D clustering in a and ACT CMB Lansing, now ACT CMB Lansing should be a lot better than Planck. We have it basically, the analysis on that is being finalized as we speak. We have an MOU between ACT and DESI. So indeed, we are going to do all of these analyses with the newest and greatest sort of CMB, wide field CMB maps and sort of spectroscopic samples, right? And we're going to jointly analyze, you know, the 3D power spectrum Lansing cross correlations. So I think this is a very promising way of trying to understand what's going on. Putting sort of everything together, this is a summary plot of made by, I think, Joe DeRose. And here shows some of the recent results. So the CMB is up here, right? It's fully consistent among each other. Then this was like, you know, several analyses of kids, DS, and HSC. This is shear only. Then if you include galaxy, you know, shear and galaxy clustering are these points. The two CMB Lansing analyses I talked about in this talk are these two points. Then you can also include some clustering data. Things don't really change. Interestingly enough, these last few points, right, they are only 3D clustering of galaxies. These are both power spectrum and bispectrum, right? And they also come out low, and they also come out low by roughly the same amount. Okay, so my two cents on all of this. So I think the short summary is, I think we may have a serious problem and it's worth paying attention to it. And note that when I say serious problem, I don't necessarily mean new physics or I say it is actually low, right? If indeed we have all of these different methods and we all get the wrong answer by 10-15%, right? We also have a problem, right? If we can't do an analysis, none of us can do an analysis that is not biased by 2.5 or 3 sigma, then we do have a problem when, you know, we're thinking about the LSST era or the DESI era, where we claim, you know, percent level sort of precision. You know, if we can't get the answer right, but if I say it is truly this at low redshift, right, and we're all getting it wrong, that is also a serious problem, right? So I don't know where the problem lies, but I think we do have a serious problem. Or it could be true that, you know, them for whatever reason, you know, new physics, baryons, anything, you know, for whatever reason, the amplitude of low redshift the matter fluctuations is lower than expected. That is also a problem that we should understand why, right? Okay, so no obvious common systematics. So, you know, I talked about, you know, galaxy clustering. I talked about CMB Lansing, galaxy Lansing. They are very different systematics. They are very different measurements on different scales. You know, one thing is in common is some of our like theory models. So, you know, do we all use some perturbation theory derived models? Perhaps that perturbation theory fails on much larger scales than we expect. You know, I talk to the experts and they tell me, oh, that's mathematically impossible, right? But perhaps galaxies are harder than thought to. And you know, note especially CMB Lansing information comes from rather large scales. This is almost like a linear theory problem. Okay, as I showed, you know, photometric redshifts are likely not the cause. projection of volume effects, this goes back on how do you do like some Bayesian inference. When I wrote this slide, I was thinking, at least for us, for you know, the unwise analysis and Bayesian analysis, we looked into this carefully. And I don't think we are so dominated by projection of volume effects. However, there's some interesting literature recently, especially on this RSD analysis, where I would say, you know, the jury is still out whether, you know, a projection effects are a problem or not there. So this is actually an interesting point that I'd love to discuss with many of you if you have a better way to do this analysis. What about neutrinos? I mean, the first thing you probably think about when you say, well, low redshift structure is lower than CMB, well, that's exactly what neutrinos do, right? But the neutrino-induced suppression for the minimum mass normal hierarchy is about 3%, and here we are talking about 15% of suppression. Right? So this discrepancy is too large that it would break everything else if you had massive enough neutrinos to agree with the lensing data. In fact, DS did a very good analysis in which they, you know, really very, very neutrino mass, and high values of neutrino mass are not preferred once you include other cosmological data set in. So it's probably not neutrinos. Just a statistical fluctuation is very unlikely. And here's where we go a bit in the sociology, right? Because a lot of the papers have gone, oh, it's only a 2.5, 3 sigma fluctuation, could be statistics, right? But when you have 15 papers on different measurements that all find a 3 sigma fluctuation.
Why do you combine them?
Can I come back to I'll come back to that in a second. Yes. So just a statistical fluctuation, I think, is very, very unlikely. Okay. On the other hand, maybe people haven't paid too much attention to this SA problem because it's hard to find compelling a new fundamental physics that can explain this. And I have some ideas that I don't super dislike, but again, they are a bit, you know, far-fetched. Okay, so of course, looking at systematics in the data is the first thing you should do. But now we are kind of running out of things to look for. So the problem, as I showed in the first part of my talk, is way worse on very small scales. So maybe that hints at some, galaxy formation could be playing a role. But then that goes back into the maybe perturbation theory fails on larger scales than we think. I'm really excited about sort of this combination of 3D power spectrum and lensing together with the Z calibration of baryon effects that will make our analysis a lot more robust in the future. So I just want to say stay tuned, and I'm out of time. So thank you very much. Happy to answer questions. Okay. So maybe I'll go to Nyayesh. So, okay, first of all, why don't you combine? Well, you know, Alex and I have already been discussing a lot what should we combine and, how we should do it. I know some of the weak lensing surveys are working very hard to combine your kids and DES, for example. It's not as easy as, multiplying the likelihoods because the parameter sets are very different. Once you multiply, volume effects are relevant, and especially, the systematics between, for example, if you use the same intrinsic alignment model, right, your systematics will be correlated between the data sets. So it's not just a simple kind of multiplication of the likelihood. You can jointly analyze the data, and I believe that's being done, right? Maybe you want to say more. So it's non-trivial, right? Yeah.
But at least, your analysis is, completely independent from the axis. So those you can back
into. Yeah, you can add them in quadrature, and then you end up with, 3.5 sigma tension. But I don't even, in a sense, I don't even need to see the combined. I know that just a statistical fluke is just very unlikely.
I think somebody write that number.
Well, just adding quadrature if you want, right? But
because I guess the Hubble tension people say is 4 sigma, but
it's based. it's based on one measurement, right? This is based on like you know. Yeah, this is based on so many different measures, different techniques and stuff. So
if you get more sigma from this, it's more reliable than the
force sigma. I completely agree. I mean, I think then again, I think I take this way more seriously than take Hubble. Right. And then again, recently I got a little bit concerned about some of these points and, you know, the way people do, including ourselves, do Bayesian inference on parameters. But I'm happy. I mean, that's what something I was discussing with Kendrick like an hour ago.
Roughly, how does it perform? Like, what are the theory inputs that go in there?
The primary CMB here? This primary, you're saying what's dominating the error bars or what? Sorry.
No,
so
this is which ref sheet for the
extrapolation of the primary CMB? This set is where defined a redshift zero, but everything is extrapolated to redshift zero. So basically, you don't measure S8 from this. You measure cosmological parameters, and then you use linear theory to infer, what your value of S8 should be, right? Redshift zero. You know, use the omega. I mean, it's not exactly, you don't take the parameters of sigma 8 and omega mat and multiply them. You can actually, have a parameter in the chain, which is this exact combination, and get the full posterior, and that's really good. Yeah, but of course, you need a theory model to go from the primordial amplitude measure here to, the sigma 8, which is defined at redshift 0. So yeah, it's a model dependent, but that's exactly how this discrepancy, precisely because of that model dependence, you could if you're completely sure about systematics and everything, you could say, well, I need to modify the physics that goes from the amplitude of CMB to modify the growth of fluctuation in some way. And that's also why it's hard to do, when I said it's hard to do with new fundamental physics, is because we have really good expansion measurements, and expansion measurements completely agree with the value of omega matter measured by Planck, okay? So you can't change the expansion, but you have to change the growth without, changing the expansion growth. But you have to change the growth. So that's hard to do.
So can you say some more about why neutrinos don't help with this?
Right. So neutrinos, again, I think the reason they don't help is that you would need such a ridiculously high mass.
What is the number
even? So the suppression is, of order 10 to 15%, depending on the measurement, right? And neutrinos is at 3%. So, the
0.82 versus 0.78, is that what you said, like the numbers were? So that's like a 5% difference?
It's like a 10%. It's 0.77 versus 0.83.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Is like 0.05 or
so. But that's already assuming on the top of minimum mass neutrinos, right? So that extrapolation is already including the effect of minimum mass. So you need the neutrinos to be like four times or so the minimum mass, right?
And so minimum mass is like 0.05, and so this would be like 0.2.
Something like that, right? And but that breaks. Like if you put it in a likelihood with some PAO, for example, right? Then you'd see that high mass neutrinos are not preferred over just the minimum mass, right? In fact, there's basically no constraining power on neutrinos from this, which is kind of very counterintuitive. And if you really had lensing alone, you can absorb that into some very, very high neutrino mass. But once you include any other sort of cosmological data set, the DS papers have a nice plot where they show like the neutrinos versus omega matter, and the neutrinos are completely very wide prior, when neutrinos are completely unconstrained. Because I think the problem is, if you move, like you have a plot with neutrino mass on some axis, right? As you move along the axis, when you go to high neutrino mass, the lensing is happy, but everything else is unhappy, right? And then so it's always a bad fit in a sense, right? You cannot find a value in neutrino mass that makes all of the data a good fit at the same time. I can pull up the plot.
Yeah, okay, yes. Yeah. Wrong, maybe.
Okay, there are no other questions.